Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
Welcome to Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. Joining me, as always, my lovely co-host, Nadia Oxford.
Hello, everybody. I have a cold, so I'm a bit sniffly and everything, so please forgive me.
And special guest, Katie McCarthy.
I don't remember the last time I was actually on this.
It's been a minute. Maybe the last time you were here was the last time we talked about The World Ends With You, which was about a year ago.
I feel like one more time, but that's like the last time I remember being on this.
Katie, you're here because you recently checked out The World Ends With You on Switch, so we're going to talk about that, and we're also going to be talking about Assassin's Creed Odyssey, which you've also been playing, and that will be with our reviews editor, Mike Williams. We're going to be doing our full review on that one with no spoilers. And as usual, before we get started, if you want to have any comment or feedback, follow us on all of the social medias. I'm at @the_catbot. Nadia is currently suspended from Twitter. Free Nadia, #.
No, I was freed. I am free. I am a free woman.
Yeah, I was like, Nadia is freed last night. She's back. She has returned.
What? You're back?
She returned.
I have returned.
It was very
I've returned to shitpost in all my glory.
You did it.
Yeah, I did it already. I sat there on my ass for 7 days and waited for something to happen. That's all I got.
Did you hear anything about what? Did they just like one day you were able to log in? Or was it like they're like, congrats, you're done.
Basically, they gave me an email. They gave me an email saying, oh, yeah, it looks like you didn't violate our rules. Okay, sorry for the inconvenience. That's literally it.
You're out of Twitter jail.
Thank you for your get out of jail free card.
Welcome back to our hell.
Welcome back to hell.
Yeah.
We kept a spot for you.
That's like, I'm jealous you're able to like take a break from Twitter.
Yeah, I want to be suspended from Twitter next.
No, you don't.
But I'm at @the_catbot. Nadia's @NadiaOxford. Katie is @YouMeCatie. That's spelled YUMECATY. And of course, follow us on US Gamer @USGamerNet and on Facebook and Twitch and all of that good stuff. Lots of good stuff there. But okay, so getting back to The World Ends With You. Katie, did you play the original in 2007?
Yes, or I didn't play it in 2007 because I was late to the DS in general. I didn't get a DS till a 3DS, so like technically didn't get a DS. So I played it like when I got my 3DS because all my friends at the time were like really into The World Ends With You. And it, like, I'm really into like Kingdom Hearts, or I was into it, I guess. So I was like really into Tetsuya Nomura, so it was like right up my alley. So I probably didn't play it till like whatever year the 3DS launched, I guess. I can't remember what year that was.
So 2006?
That Japanese punk vibe is very you.
It totally is.
Yeah. It's just like very, it's a very trendy game. Like I'm really into like Jet Set Radio and stuff like that. So it just like fits like all like my check marks, I guess, internally. Like I'm like, oh, cool soundtrack. All right, I'm good. Like cool, weird, unique character designs. Like I'm all in.
Doesn't Neku wear his hoodie backwards?
He just has, like, a very tall hood. It's, like...
Yeah, it zips bunched up, in his like, front.
God, was it Bape hoodies that had, like, the zipper that goes all the way up the hood? It's, like, this...
I could not even begin to tell you. I have two pairs of jeans.
So my secret like, favorite thing about... Yeah. My secret favorite thing about The World Ends With You has always been that if you get Neku's courage up high enough, you can just buy all of the ladies' fashion and have him wear that.
I forgot about that until I was playing the Switch version. And I was like, oh, your bravery's not high enough. And I was like, oh, I forgot about this part. It's so cute.
Oh, I bet it looks so nice.
Cross-dressing. That's cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I've mentioned before that The World Ends With You came out while I was living in Japan. So I walked through Shibuya every day on the way to work. So Shibuya was kind of my hood. It was my town. So playing it and being involved in that world was really great for me because having grown up in Minnesota, I never really had a game that was like, here's an open world game set in my hometown. for obvious reasons. And so I never had that effect of playing, say, GTA 4 or Watch Dogs 2 or Fallout 4 and seeing New York or Boston or San Francisco or even Seattle.
The only time I really had that at all, I think, was, I'm sure someone will correct me with another one, but Scott Pilgrim was the only time I played a game in Toronto.
That's too bad, because Toronto's a cool city.
Yeah, I think so, but tell game developers that.
One day I'm going to get my GTA Minneapolis, and I'm going to feed somebody into a wood chipper, and it'll be great.
I was going to say, no, you're not, but then I realized, wait, you can feed someone into a wood chipper. That'd be a great idea.
So I recognized everything in Shibuya immediately, and I really enjoyed just running through it and everything. The other thing that was revelatory about it for me, and as I said, we covered it in the retrospective from last year, but the soundtrack was outstanding. And it was especially impressive that they managed to get it onto a cartridge for the Nintendo DS, that it was so extensive and that it changed up as you got further into the game. It was really great in that regard.
Yeah, you're right. That's a good point. I never thought about that. How much work it must have taken to get that soundtrack. First of all, it didn't sound like compressed at all, like you usually get with a game like that. They had to fit on the DS. So that was it was just a really good piece of work all around by Square Enix.
I'm also optimistic by nature, and I liked The World Ends With You's main thrust of kind of getting Neku to come out of his shell and stop being a dick. His arc works a lot better than Squall's, I think, because Neku is just the worst for the first like few hours of the game. He's just absolutely terrible.
So insufferable. Yeah.
Terrible to Shiki, basically going, I don't care if you die. But by the end of the first week, I mean, he's really kind of stopped being a jerk. He's really come out of his shell. And then the story. One of the things I've always found the most interesting about The World Ends With You is the first week is its own complete arc. And by the end, you're used to Shiki, you're ready to fight the big battle, and then it kind of hits the reset button, and you're put together with a new character, and you're going, and you are just as disoriented as Neku, because you're trying to get used to using this new character, and it takes some doing, and that's actually one aspect that gets lost in the iPad and the Switch version, I think.
Yeah, it's because, like, obviously the dual screen, you're using, like, face buttons and touch screen, and there's, like, this, you have to, it's a really, like, it's hard to get the handle of, but once you do, it's, like, really satisfying. And I feel like with this version, it's basically just, like, another pin. It's, like, another ability that you can use, and it kind of, it really loses, like, the, like, not just, like, the narrative element of, like, oh, it's, like, dual screens, dual people, but it's, like, oh, they're just two. It's like almost like a party system now. Whereas I don't think the DS version really feels like a party system.
Right.
But it's really strange. So yeah, the Switch version like changes. It's pretty much the iOS version. So or iOS and Android, where if it's portable, you can play a touchscreen, and that's how I've been playing it mostly because it's probably the preferred way. Or you can play Joy-Cons on the TV, but it's like you only play with one Joy-Con and you use the motion controls to like put a reticle on the screen, so it's kind of like a little cursor. But the problem is in battle, it gets like super crazy, like it just like starts jittering and sometimes it'll get stuck on the like side of the screen and you have to like, you're constantly having to reset it, and luckily it's super easy to reset it to the middle, but it's so annoying.
Still.
It's like... Like, I've died, like, I don't think it's, like, a particularly hard game, but I feel like I died because the reticle just goes crazy, and I just get frustrated. I'm like, this just sucks. Like, this is not a great situation.
Just a quick question. If I'm playing in handheld mode, I have to use touchscreen or nothing?
Yeah, touchscreen. There's no, you can't use, like, the Joy-Cons connected to the side of it.
Oh, that's really kind of, that's a downer. I mean, I have a stylus for, that's good for Switch, but that's not the point.
Yeah, it's... I guess it might... I don't have a stylus that works on my Switch, so it might work with the stylus, but... Yeah, it's just touchscreen or motion Joy-Con. And, that, like, the good thing about the Joy-Cons is, like, you could bring in another player. Like, now there's co-op to control the other character. And I feel like that only particularly works well in boss battles, because how they change boss battles from the DS version is... The DS version is, like... The other character will be at like a different part of the boss. Like they're like doing different things, so it's kind of like like interesting like tag team element almost. Whereas with the iOS and Switch version, it's like one character will just jump up to like this new area for the boss, and then they're doing a different thing. But the cool thing about co-op is, like, since they're, like, different characters, like, oh, like, now your co-op partner's doing this other thing while you're, like, waiting, I guess. And that feels kind of cool, but in, like, the actual battles you run around and, like the noise you face, like, mostly, it's just, it just makes the battles really easy because now you have another player instead of using, like, an extra ability.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
But you can set it to be really hard.
Yeah, but... I don't know.
If you set it at the absolute highest difficulty level, I could totally see where co-op would be really useful.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. And the other player, from what I noticed, is invulnerable. Like, they can't be hurt. It's, like, only Neku that can be hurt.
Like, so Tails. Like,
yeah, and they have, like, a set thing of abilities. So that's kind of a bummer. You can't, like, the other player can't really... they can't customize their pins or anything. They're just kind of like stuck as that character, and they only can run around in battles. Like, they can't run around in the main hub world or anything. So it's definitely like a weird drop-in co-op. I feel like it's a cool idea, and I don't know, like, The World Ends With You has kind of always been like a weirdly controlled game, so of course it would have a weird control scheme for Switch.
Yeah,
but I just don't think it quite works that well. I'm honestly
kind of curious to try it now on my TV with my partner playing co-op, because that would be a different way to enjoy The World Ends With You. And since we both were in Japan together, like, I could see that as being a fun nostalgia trip.
I feel like that's like probably the thing that I would maybe recommend if people are interested in rechecking it out, or haven't. If you haven't played World Ends With You before, like, it's the Switch version's
well, this
like
is literally the first time that it's been available on TV. It's always been available on handheld in every iteration. Even its Kingdom Hearts appearance was on handheld.
I mean, that was remastered for consoles, so I mean, technically you can play that on your TV now. But yeah, it's definitely like, and the art looks really good. Like, it's like really crisp. And you can switch between the DS music, which is cool. And I've been playing with the DS music on because I don't know, it's like kind of like nostalgia, you know? It's like, oh, it's nice to hear, like, this, like, crunchy sound again. But the remix soundtrack's really good, too. But yeah, like, I kind of had this idea of, like, you know, like, the Flip Grip that Jeremy helped design? The, like, vertical Switch handle? Like, I was thinking it'd be cool if they did, like... Yeah. If they, like... patched in like a vertical function that split the screen in half, and maybe like each Joy-Con side on the Flip Grip would like control a different character. I was like, that would be cool. Yeah, but I don't know if
that's actually a really good idea, practical. Especially since Wii U its tablet had the option to do that with DS games that came out on the Virtual Console.
Oh really? I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
Oh whoa. That, yeah, like, I was like, because I was, like, thinking, like, what would be a cool, weird control scheme for this? And then I was like, oh, that would be cool, but I feel like that's a lot to patch in. But I also imagine that people are going to be complaining probably a lot about the fact there's, like, two control schemes, and one's basically just, like, the iOS version. It's, like, that's not going to fly well with a lot of people, I think.
Yeah, I guess sorry, Kat, didn't mean to interrupt you there.
I was going to say, I think the main reason to play through the Switch version is if you haven't already played it and you don't have easy access to the iOS version and you want to enjoy this really, it's still a really unique RPG kind of experience. It's not something that we've really seen a ton of out of Nomura and Square Enix. And I would argue that perhaps the battle system is actually one of the weaker parts of the game anyway, and it always has been. I remember, like, I basically scratched my screen up so badly playing that game on the Nintendo DS.
Furrows everywhere.
It was, well, I mean, because I was scratching so hard, like, on boss battles, especially some of the really hard boss battles, because you have to kind of draw shapes, right, to make the pins work. And it's kind of the similar with the other versions. And so invariably, it's like repetitive actions over and over and over again. And so there's some strategy to the way that you implement your pins and attach them, and to the clothes that you select for your character and how you manage trends and everything. But when it comes to the actual battles, I mean, it's just scratch, 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 scratch. So
you just put your cat up against your DS screen and let him go at it.
If you've already played The World's End with you, I think the two main reasons to pick this up, maybe co-op, and then also because there's content at the end of the game.
Right.
So, the requirements to unlock it are really hard, so I don't think I'll ever see it. Like, I'm not close to the end, but like I was reading up on it, and I was like, yeah, I don't think I have it in me to unlock this like epilogue. And I don't even know how long it is. Like, I'm wondering if it's, like, is it, like, a full week? I don't think it's going to be, like, that extensive. Like, I feel like it's probably going to be, like, a 1 or 2 hour thing. So, I don't really know if the epilogue will be worth it. Like, kind of like Persona 3 Fez. Like, Persona 3 Fez has the answer epilogue, which is, like, 20 hours. So, it's, like, definitely, like, way more expansive. But it's, like, not... It doesn't have, like, the cool things you like Persona 3 for. Like, it's mostly just... like non-choice based dialogue and like fighting and dungeon crawling, so it's not like actually... the cool social aspects. It's more just like tying up like the end, which I don't think really needed it. Like I don't hate the answer because like it's still like I still think the story in it is good, but it's not necessary to your enjoyment of Persona 3. So I'm curious about The World Ends With You's epilogue, but I also have not seen it yet, so it could be like. It could be, like, teasing a sequel or something crazy, which I wouldn't be surprised.
I used to want a sequel. I don't want a sequel anymore.
Yeah, I don't, like, after playing this, I'm like, I don't... How would it control? Like, I feel like I almost would have preferred, like, a 3DS remake or something. Like, something that still has that stylus-enabled dual touchscreen. Maybe, like, refining that battle system more, because it is super clunky on DS. Mm-hmm. But I feel like that's also so key to that game.
I agree, but at the same time, maybe not, in the sense that I think what is actually extremely key to The World Ends With You is the unique structure in the way that it tells the story, the unique modern-day setting, that wonderful soundtrack. If you capture all of that, I think you can mess around with the way the battle system works and honestly make it a lot better.
Yeah, like, I'd like to see a, like, reimagined version that kind of has, like, the same idea almost as the DS version. I just feel like this, like, redesigned battle system, like, it's just kind of boring. Like, it's not as, like, interesting. Like, at least the DS one was, like, interesting. I was like, wow, this is, like, a really unique idea I've never seen before. Whereas this one's just, like, tapping on enemies and swiping at enemies and, like, it's like, I like the pin system a lot, like, how you're, like, getting new, you're like kind of like creating your own arsenal of like magic and like telekinesis and like physical like stuff, and you're kind of like building up like, okay, like it's kind of like a card game basically. You're like building up your own deck, like, okay, this is like what I'm gonna bring into this battle, or I'll bring in this like side deck I have. And I like that aspect of it a lot, because it's like you only have like 5 abilities when you have all of them unlocked, so it's like not that much at the end of the day. And I'd like to see that system maybe pushed a little farther if they did a sequel or something, and like playing with the fact that, like, the partner system like in a more interesting way, like something that like is as interesting as its structure, I guess.
The thing that's always kind of given me pause about the idea of a sequel is the original The World Ends With You ties up extremely nicely. It ends Neku's story.
Yeah,
and
it would have to be new characters. I feel like that would be the ideal sequel, is like new characters, and like I don't really know, but I'm not like dying for a sequel maybe as I was back when I first played it. It's more like
there's a lot of mystery going on at the end of The World Ends With You. Like, you're kind of going, what is actually the deal with Joshua? What actually is the world with the deal with this kind of afterlife world? Spoiler alert, you're dead. You learned that really early.
Yeah, they took that away.
And you do get some answers. You get quite a few answers, actually, if you do the the end game content in the original World's Ends with You, because there are these papers that you can collect. But I don't really, like, based on what happened with Kingdom Hearts, where it started to over-explain everything and everything got too insane.
It never stopped.
I'm kind of happy. I'm kind of okay with not knowing all that much about the backstory.
Yeah, I'm worried this epilogue is going to do, like, so Kingdom Hearts 2, I feel like the problems that game has, it has a really good ending, like, core, like, key, like, pre-credits ending where it's like, oh, like, everyone's, like, reunited, they're back on Destiny Island, everything seems chill and happy and, like, a little sad because they went on this big journey, but they're all, like, you know, they're all together, like, Mickey, Riku, Donald, Goofy, Sora, and Kyrie. And then there's, like, a post-credit scene which just sets up, like, whatever happens after Kingdom Hearts 2, which is, like, where we're at now. And it's like, man, that ending was so good. And then they just had to keep going. Like, I feel like it was, like, such a satisfying ending. Like, it was, like, everything seemed chill. And then it just... Now we're getting Kingdom Hearts 3.
Yes. Square Enix is tempted to, like, do that.
It's like the end of Thor Ragnarok. And if you care about the spoiler to this now year-old movie, you might want to skip ahead a couple minutes. But at the end of Thor Ragnarok, everybody is gathered up. And Thor has taken on his, like, rightful role as the new king and all that. And you're like, great, this is awesome.
Yeah, it's like a happy ending.
And then the post-credits scene is a giant spaceship coming down, casting a shadow over them. And, oh, now they're all dead.
And they sure were.
It was such a bummer what they did in Infinity War. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I agree.
I was not in... I'm not the biggest fan of Infinity War in general, but yeah, it's just like, I just hate, like, why can't a movie just have a good ending or something? Like, I don't know, it was just like, why do you have to, like, keep tying into the Marvel Cinematic Universe? Like, why does it keep having to, like, go in that direction? Like, I just find it really nauseating.
Just imagine the world ends with you too. Oh, here comes Organization 13.
Kill me now. I'll jump out the balcony myself. Don't bother.
Turns out Neku's appearance in Kingdom Hearts for the 3DS was actually canon.
How did they even justify that? Why was he there?
Because Kingdom Hearts, they just always put people in there because they're going to.
That's true. They have, like, sets where they're playing
games. That's like asking, why are characters from Final Fantasy X and Final Fantasy VIII in there? Why is Tidus there? Because...
I feel like one justifies it, where it's like, oh, they're all from, like, Radiant Garden, now Hollow Bastion, and then, you know, there's, like, this narrative, like, it makes sense. Like, okay, that's the Final Fantasy characters world. That's why, like, Squall is hanging out with, like, Aerith or whatever. But, yeah, in Dream Drop Distance, I think it's, like, the Hercules Coliseum world, and it's, like, Neku and I think Zack from Final Fantasy VII.
Oh, like, God, what a
Crisis
team.
Core, I guess. It's like I'm trying to remember, like, who else is there. I think it is just, like, Neku and Zack, and it's just like, all right, maybe it's just Zack actually. No, Zack's in Birth by Sleep now I'm thinking about it. Okay, I don't remember the context of the World Ends with You character.
I am really, really shocked right now.
What rabbit hole have we gone down? My God.
Zack's definitely in the Hercules world in Birth by Sleep, because I remember he, like, asks Aqua out on a date, and it's really weird.
Doesn't he have a girlfriend? Isn't Aeris his girlfriend?
Yeah, basically. I mean, they're all, like,
yeah, now he's,
like,
hitting on these underage girls. Jeez.
Yeah.
That too. Ew. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Sephiroth and Cloud live in Hercules' world as well, hanging out in that Colosseum.
Yeah, they're just chilling.
Why the hell not? I live in Hercules' world now too, everyone. Hi.
I think the Hercules world's been in every Kingdom Hearts game. I might be wrong on that. Someone's going to, like,
yeah,
cause it's me a, on Twitter, like, it's, no, they're not in this one.
It's because it's a convenient Colosseum area.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly why.
And because Hades is a major enemy and a great enemy to boot.
Yeah.
Anyway, getting back to The World Ends With You, I would say that if you never played it on the DS and you don't have an iPad and you're eyeing it on the Nintendo Switch, I would still pick it up because it is a great... If nothing else, it is a really unique experience, the way that it lets you scale battles basically dynamically, the setting, the way that it really does such a nice job of capturing Shibuya, that really distinctive art, which I would say it's good Nomura more than it is bad Nomura.
Definitely.
I am an optimistic person, and The World Ends With You is actually a pretty optimistic game, all told. I think the characters are all pretty good. I think the world is good. The story really had me hooked. The weak structure really works. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, it's fun going to all of the different clothing shops and getting the clothes for your characters so that you can power them up with the different pins and finding the different pins for your powers. It's a nice, very nice little 15 to 20 hour experience. And it has a kind of a special place in my heart. So you should go check it out. Do you guys have any further thoughts, Nadia?
No, I agree with you. It's a great game, and especially what was really special was getting to play it when the first, like, in the time period it came out in, when it really seemed like JRPGs were just on the rocks. And here came this really, like, very unique game that really reveled in its uniqueness, and I'll always appreciate it for that.
Yeah, it's really, I feel like it's, even now, it's super unique among most JRPGs, or most RPGs in general. Like, it's just, like, has this really good structure, like, story-wise and format-wise, and I don't know, like, I love, like, a good, well-executed, unique RPG, because, like, I don't know, sometimes they do, I don't want to call, like, RPGs samey, but, you know, it's, like, there's usually, like, a structure it's, like, stuck to, so it's, like, always cool to see an RPG kind of, like, do something against, like, the RPG rules. Like, doesn't have an RPG boss.
You're gonna break all the rules, man. Like, Neku doesn't conform to your society.
All right, we're back. Katie is still on the line with me, and we're also adding in our reviews editor, Mike Williams, official Assassin's Creed fan, because, Mike, Assassin's Creed, it's an RPG now. We can officially call it that.
It is full-on an RPG, and if you were sad and disappointed about Mass Effect Andromeda, Assassin's Creed Odyssey is pretty much the closest thing that you have to that type of game for the foreseeable future, right?
You mean it had spaceships and stuff? Man, I didn't know that much.
It doesn't have spaceships, but it does have ocean ships, which aren't like spaceships, but they do have a crew.
It's not the same, though. I mean, I'm not flying through the Sea of Stars, talking to aliens and having sex with them.
No, but you are flying through the Sea of Oceans, talking to people and having sex with them.
It's true. You do have a lot of sex, from my understanding, in Assassin's Creed Odyssey.
But you don't see any of it. It's like a fade to black. It's like very PG-13. It's like kind of a bummer. I'm like, damn, I want to like see some stupid action. Like, I want some like weird, uncomfortable shit. But no, it's just like they kiss, and then like usually it's like, oh, they go into the house, and then that's it.
Katie's all about the weird and uncomfortable shit.
Yeah, like, yeah. I mean, Witcher 3 has some, like, really weird sex scenes, and it's hilarious and great.
I think that's why they avoided it, because every time you try to do that in games, it just looks odd.
Yeah.
Like, someone had to sit there and pose those models, and it just doesn't work out quite right.
Like, there's a great scene with Geralt and Yennefer on, like, a unicorn, and it's just, like, a very strange scene, and it's great. It's like, I mean, it's definitely treated with like seriousness, but also like a sense of humor to it. I feel like there's like a really good balance, I feel like that's really hard, because most times sex in games just doesn't really work that well.
Yeah, and most of them cut to black, but like two or three of them are like long enough to like give a mood, like the one with the old lady.
Yeah.
To set the context for the people here, the start of the quest is there's this old, very horny lady who wants you to go find an aphrodisiac and stamina enhancer thing for her husband so they can continue to have sex. And when you finally do that, the husband is like, you know what? No. Nope. I'm sorry.
Yeah, he's like, I'm not too tired.
Yeah, he's like, I'm not going to do this. And the option then is to take your payment and leave, or they're swingers, apparently, have sex with the wife. And that scene is like, literally, like, you go into the house, and then it's the husband sitting outside, and then he, like, picks up a guitar or lute or something, and then people come and talk, and, like, the time of day is changing. It's a very
it's really
weird
funny.
Scene.
Hey, it's not ages, though. Good on Assassin's Creed Odyssey.
Yeah, no, she that lady is ready to go, like, as soon as she meets you.
Right on. I'm totally down with that. I think it's interesting that Assassin's Creed Odyssey, there was a lot of talk right after the review embargo lifted that it focused a lot more on flings than lasting romances, and you seemed pretty down with that, Mike.
I like it because it gives you freedom. Like, not 100% the problem. The problem I had in games like Dragon Age or Mass Effect is, like, you had to pick one romance, and that was it. Like, that was the person that you were with. And then it got really weird, you know, as you move from Mass Effect 1 to 2 to 3, because the options would change per game. Whereas in...
Well, you could totally ditch your previous girlfriend.
Yeah, you could.
Like,
but
there's even a bit in Mass Effect 2 where, like, you would be having sex with somebody and then you would very carefully put the picture of your previous love down.
Right, see, I felt guilty.
Yeah, but it lets you change it. And it's basically saying, oh, yeah, I mean, you can mess around all you want, but it's kind of realistic in that regard, right?
Yeah. Whereas Odyssey is like, you know what? Do whatever you want. Like, no matter which character you are, you can have as much or as little sex as you want with anybody. It doesn't matter. And that feels really, like, freeing. And depending on how you play, allows you to define your character a little bit more. If you want to be asexual, you can be asexual. If you want to be bisexual, you can be bisexual. It allows you to do a lot more, I think, in terms of role-playing.
Go and be free, right?
Yeah, like, what do you think, Katie? How far did you get?
So, I'm still, like, I got to Athens maybe, like, 5 hours ago on my save, so I've just been, like, bumming around Athens and, like, sailing around the random islands and stuff. So I've only seen, like, I think, like, three romance things so far. So, like, it's, like, not that... there's not a lot. Like, I was expecting kind of there to be more, honestly. And I kind of wish they were a little deeper, but there's still, like, the freedom aspect. Like, I feel like I keep, like, going back to Witcher 3 because I feel like that's, like, another big RPG-type thing. But, like, The Witcher 3 has, like, you have, like, Yennefer or Triss, and those are, like, your two main love interests. But there's also, like, little flings along the way that you can pursue. Right. And I kind of like that element where it's, like, you still have that freedom if you want, and there's, like, consequences if you try to romance both Yennefer and Triss, because obviously it's, like, not a great thing to do. But there's still, like, that freedom, like, you can still hook up with, like, I can't remember that one sorceress's name. And then the DLC, there's, like, a romance. And there's, like, more freedom, I feel like, in, like, the moment-to-moment. Whereas, or, like, even, like, in Persona, where you can technically romance, like, everyone, but then you have, like, a big consequence in the end. So I'm kind of bummed that there's not, like, this, like, deeper romance I've encountered yet in Odyssey. Like, I kind of wish there was, like, a Yennefer equivalent or something.
You will run into it on an extra island, and it's the choice between Kira. I think you played it in the one of the preview events. Kira and Stentor, which is a dude and a lady, their resistance on the island, and you can choose between them. And those are a bit deeper. And like I said in the thing with the flings, like, I like the freedom, but I think they should aim for all of the romantic options to be either funnier, like the old lady, funny and weird, or the deeper one like Kira or Stentor, depending on which one you choose. I chose Kira.
Yeah, I haven't encountered that yet, but yeah, so I feel like I'm like, I'm into the idea, but I kind of wish there was like a deeper element, at least more common than like one romance, as it seems, basically.
But AC Odyssey doesn't really seem to want to be a quote-unquote deeper game in general. And I'm not just talking about romances. I'm talking from the standpoint of decision-making in general. I'm talking about mechanically. It's definitely an RPG in the sense that you have stats and you have builds for your characters and you're making decisions that impact the story and the world, but it really wants to have it both ways and be both an RPG and a kind of a light action game in the vein of Assassin's Creed.
I feel like it's really trying, it's really leaning into the RPG stuff. I just don't think it's quite nailed it yet. Like, the choice thing is, like, a big change, and the romance system is, like, a big change, but I feel like they're not quite good yet. Like, I feel like there's a lot of exposition, which is kind of a bummer, like, in terms of, like, choice making. Like, if I'll have, like, a conversation, and there will be, like, a callback to a choice I made, like, on another island or something, and I kind of wish it was a little more naturally, I guess, introduced, like, the choice and consequence things. I know isn't there like 7 different endings, Mike, or am I getting that wrong? There's like a lot of different endings.
You are correct. Yeah. You are correct. And most of those actually stem from really early choices you made. So it's not like, say, Mass Effect 3, where you get to the end and you choose between 3 different endings. It's you did this way back in Chapter 2. And that feeds, and that feeds into which of the endings you get. Like the first major choice is, whatever you did with the wolf, who is your father, and that determine that is part of what determines which of the endings you'll get at the end.
I guess that makes sense because I feel like that's like the big thrust, right? It's like your
family,
family. Like you're like basically reuniting your family who's like kind of scattered all across Greece, and obviously hit some bumps in the road. But yeah, I don't know. I also don't think the story's that good. I think that's like probably my main problem with Odyssey so far is I feel like I'm way more engaged with the side quests than the main story itself, which is kind of a bummer because I feel like Origins was like both, like I was really into the main story and I was also into the side quests. And I feel like with this, it's like just one half of the game I'm really engaging with.
Yeah, I'd say the like Aya and Bayek's revenge tale felt a little bit more immediate. Mm. Whereas this is, hey, get your family back together, even though some of them are kind of neutral, some of them are kind of evil. One of them was just gone for a while. You can tell they were trying because a lot of the side quests, if you look at them like in aggregate, are about other families. Mm. A whole lot of the like major side quests are about family. And you can tell that they were trying to tie both of those sides together. But I agree, like the family reunion thing is kind of vanilla. Is probably my best,
and it kind of like leans really hard into like the kind of like Assassin's Creed nonsense, you know, like the Spear of Leonidas.
Oh, the first civilization.
God, I like that's the thing I can't stay, like I don't care about any of the modern day stuff or like the weird magical stuff. Like I just hate it. Like I just want like the cool historical world to like run around in. And it really leans into that from like the get go, pretty much. And that's
It's been like that since the original Assassin's Creed.
Yeah, right. That's like the one thing that has like that's been like the barrier for me. You know, it's like I don't care about the Animus. I don't care about Templar and Assassins. Like that's like that's like the shit.
No, I'm totally with Katie.
Oh, how dare you!
I'm sorry. Like the moment
the Animus is the worst part.
Yeah, it's so. Luckily, there's not that.
I mean,
much
all I really want is a neat historical setting. I don't need anything to tie it all together.
Yeah, same.
I don't need friggin' aliens. I mean, it's cool that you fight the Pope in Assassin's Creed too, but all of the modern day stuff has always been so boring.
Yeah, and there's like only like I've only countered like 2 scenes of the like of Layla, I think her name is, who's like the new.
She doesn't get a She doesn't get a ton of scenes. So the two scenes that you've gotten, there's like one more.
Oh, there's only one more? I'm like 20 hours, 25 to be, hours.
Yeah, because it's not really about Layla. So the there's only like three modern day scenes I can think of off the top of my head. But it does lean heavily on the mythology of that first civilization thing, which is one of those things that a lot of Assassin's Creed fans care about. Like when I went to the Reddit, like people were asking, like, so does this pick up the story of the first civilizations? Do we find out what happened to Juno? And it was like, yeah, see, and like, and like the Assassin's Creed comic was purely at the end of it about the first civilization stuff, like this slow burning plot of that in the
background. There'll always be nerds who are into that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I totally get that.
Sorry, nerds.
Yeah. Plus the first civilization thing allows them to do the weirder things that they do in this game. Ubisoft has been pretty open about it, that you will fight against creatures of myth. They've shown the Medusa pretty prominently. And the trick there to make it work is the first civilization stuff. So
yeah, but you don't need that.
Yeah.
You could have had a hardcore, interesting historical civilization without all of the monsters and demons and things.
Like, that's what annoyed me about Origins, too. It's like, you, like, run around in the desert, and you hit a glitch, and then suddenly you're fighting, like, Anubis in the desert, and it's like, why is this happening?
Oh, that was a great fight, though.
That was an annoying boss fight, too. It's like a lot of dodging and just, like, running around, and,
You mean, like, a fight?
it's like a very long fight. I don't know. It was just, like, not... It wasn't, like, an exciting... It was just like, wow, it looks cool, and that's, like, the extent of the coolness of that fight, I guess.
Getting back to what you were saying about the side quests not being a lot more interesting than the main story, when you say that, I think that's interesting because it sounds a little like it has a bit of a Fallout syndrome going on, where a game like Fallout will be able to tell a lot of really good, short, contained stories within the context of the side quests to the point where that's kind of all you want to do because the main story isn't actually all that interesting.
Oh, yeah. No, it's exactly like Fallout 4, where you're like, what happened to your family, your son? You don't really care.
I don't care. I want to go see what they're all doing on the end, on the Constitution.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's exactly like Fallout 4, where, like, the main story is fine, but you don't really care. What you really care about is exploring the world and doing the side quests. So
the world is gorgeous, though, and it's so huge.
It's so big. It's very big.
It's really funny because, like, everyone was saying, or there's that headline that was circulating, like, "Oh, it doesn't get good till 15 hours in." And I know they're talking about when you get to Athens because it's like such like a Bethesda moment where you like emerge from the cave and you're like, "Wow, it's like a big ass world." And I feel like you don't hit that point until 15 hours in when you finally get to Athens and you like climb up this cliff and then all of a sudden it's like, "Wow, this is like a huge ass city." And it's kind of like this, like, oh, this game just keeps going. And that's, it's kind of like a funny moment because it happens so late in the game.
Yeah. I thought it was good before then.
No, I was enjoying it, but I thought it was like, I guess that's what they're talking about. It's like when you reach Athens, but it is definitely like, wow, this is like a huge city. It's like so much bigger than anything else you've like encountered before it.
They do that in Witcher 3 as well.
That's like
White Orchard itself is a solid 5 hours, right?
Yeah, maybe even more.
It's definitely more because you do White Orchard, then you do the Battlegrounds area,
yeah,
the swampy Battleground area, and then you finally end up in the
Novigrad. I think is the first major continent. Technically in Assassin's Creed Odyssey, like you don't like you start out on it's some island or whatever, and then you sail away and you finally hit the title card. Kefalonia, yeah. And then you're just kind of like sailing around and that's like your first like, oh wow, I'm in this big open world moment, like beyond like the first starting area, which I feel like I've seen a lot of RPG-like games doing now, like, kind of taking this, like, mold of White Orchard, like, okay, here's, like, a starting area where you're, like, learning what you're going to do for the rest of the game, essentially, and then you get thrown into the rest of it. Which I think is pretty smart, because it's like, here's a little mini open world, and then here's the real open world.
Oh, that wonderful moment where you think you've, like, gotten pretty far into the initial areas of the game, and then the title card drops, and you're like, oh, I haven't gotten very far at all in this game.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they drop the title card, and then you, like, you're in Kefalonia, and Kefalonia is, like, 5 to 7 hours. And then the first thing I did once the title card dropped was I opened the map and zoomed out, and I was like, oh.
Yeah, it's like, okay. It's, yeah, it's a lot. It's crazy, because I was thinking about, like, how much I played Origins, and I feel like I played, like, a lot of Origins, but Origins is nowhere near as huge as this game. It's, like, really
And
weird.
Origins was gigantic. I mean, yeah. A lot of people were comparing it to Breath of the Wild.
Yeah, it was, like, really big, and this game is, like, I honestly wonder, like, the size comparison, because this, I mean, there's also, like, a bunch of water that you have to sail around, so it's, like, that's definitely a big portion of it, too.
Yeah, but, according to Ubisoft, if you take the water away, the landmass is actually smaller than the Origins map overall, but it's all spread out, and you have all the ocean there. And unlike Origins, where, like, sort of the ocean and lakes and rivers were just sort of, like, travel places, this one, like, you know, there's stuff out there. There's pirates, there's
like
spiders.
Shipwrecks and stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the major other talking points about Assassin's Creed Origins, or Odyssey, has been microtransactions and the ability to use that to lessen the grind. Certain other outlets were getting a little hysterical about it. You guys were kind of going, it's pretty overblown. So can you explain why, in your opinion, the microtransaction issue isn't a big deal?
Who was talking about this earlier? It was Stephen Totilio of Kotaku. And if you have a problem with the microtransactions in a single-player game, I get that. I can understand that. But in terms of the game actually being grindy, I found, and I've heard from a lot of other people, that just actually playing the game, like engaging with the game as normal, say if you do the main quest and the side quest, which, as we've just said, are sort of the meat of the game's story, I ended up finding out that I was over-leveled for most of the game. So, like, I just don't quite get the grindiness unless you go to every message board and pick up every quest, which you don't have to do, because what Odyssey does is it throws so much experience at you from so many different sources that you can literally choose to ignore whole mechanics in the game. Like, I stopped doing conquest battles because I just didn't really like the mechanic, even though it gives a lot of really good experience and gear. So I just, like, unless you absolutely don't want to do anything else other than the main Odyssey quest, which to me feels like leaving a whole bunch of the game on the table, even if you're just there for story, you're leaving a whole bunch of the story on the table by not doing the side quests, then, yeah, sure, you might have trouble. But otherwise, I feel it gives you so much XP that you're usually over-level for most of the game. I don't know how it is for Katie.
Yeah, I don't understand the whole, like, oh, you have to grind. Because it's like, when I think of, like, a grind, I think of, like, what I'm doing in Destiny, which is, like, replaying old heroic missions and doing the same things over and over and over again for, like, the chance of, like, an exotic drop or something. And, like, I don't, like, I'm not doing that in Odyssey. Like, I'm just kind of, like, taking things from message boards for things. I'm like, okay, like, yeah, I'll definitely be able to, like, hunt down these random soldiers or something. And, like, doing side quests as I come across them. And just, like, I feel like there's so much being thrown at me constantly that I'm, like, always at least two levels over, like, the main mission. So I'm kind of, like, yeah, I'm, like, kind of always overpowered. But everything scales with you, so you're never, like, too overpowered. Which I kind of, like, wish there's a little more flexibility, because sometimes I'm, like, I just want to go back and, like, approach this quest I was having trouble with like super ease, and that's not really doesn't seem
yeah possible. I did say that the level scaling probably needed like it currently scales two levels, so like the lowest content is always two levels below you, so you're never too far away. I think that should be increased to like three or four levels.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like that boar, did you have trouble with that boar that you have to face? Like
the first two times, yes. A lot of people are apparently having trouble with the boar.
I've tried so many times. I'm like two levels above it and it still kicks my ass. I'm like, I cannot time these dodges right apparently, because it's like, and then every time it summons, like, the little baby boars to come at you, I'm like, I hate this. I got it almost dead once, and then I died, and I've just never been able to get back to that point, and it's, I think I'm just going to give up.
Context,
I'm just not going to try it.
For context, there are a series of quests having you fight against, I think it's a total of 8 legendary beasts, including, you know, things from lore like the Nemean Lion and stuff like that. But the first one the quest sends you out to fight is this boar. And the trick with the boar is, like, when I was doing the fight the first time, I actually didn't have a problem with the boar by itself. Mm. But you hit a certain point and then it roars. It like runs away and roars and summons like 4 or 5 other boars.
Yeah, this is where I get the problem too, where it's like there's so much to deal with at once. And it happens multiple times too, which is frustrating because it's like, why can't this happen like twice and then not again? But then it just like keeps happening.
Yeah. So basically what I ended up having to do was spec warrior. And then when I'd see it roar, I was prepared. So I like had worked out the timing. So I would dodge them and then I would kill them first and then go back to the boar.
Yeah, I just can't, like, that's kind of, like, my thing, is, like, I'll shoot, like, a few arrows while the boar is, like, roaring, and I'm, like, okay, now I have time to dodge while the other ones run at me, and then it just, like, never works out. Like, I always get hit by one, it's always just one, and then that's kind of, like, ah, great, now I have to, like, stumble around and hopefully just slaughter all these baby boars so I can kill the dad boars.
Wait, did you take the heal?
The what? Oh, yeah, oh, so, yeah, I finally unlocked the healing ability. And I feel like now I can, because I was like up, I didn't even notice it was like an ability, because I was just like upgrading other abilities. I was like, oh, I want like really good poison blades or whatever. So I'm like, maybe I can probably face it now because I have this healing ability, but I also don't want to just run all the way back there because it's so far away.
Getting back to the leveling thing, I think it's a little bit similar to Witcher 3, where at a certain point, you can't just keep critical pathing the main quest. The game will more or less say, okay, time to go do some side quests. It wants you to do side quests. And I think that I'm of two minds of this, because on the one hand, I don't like getting railroaded into anything. Mm. And so I always secretly resent it when a game just kind of locks out a portion further in the game so I will see other side quest content, because I'm the kind of person who is of the mind to get through the main quest pretty fast and then go do the side content if I'm still interested in it. But the side content in Witcher 3 is so essential to the enjoyment of the game and the progression of the story that I can kind of understand why they did that. And AC Odyssey, it sounds like, does much the same thing. It just also includes the ability to be like, oh, if you don't want to do the side quests and you just want to shotgun the main story, well, you can buy some microtransactions and speed up your leveling so you can just get through it really fast. And I can kind of understand why people think that that's a little cynical on Ubisoft's part, because, I think that it does break the balance of the game a little bit anytime you start sticking in accelerators, because it's really hard to resist the temptation to gear the progression around using them.
I agree. It's, and this is why I said, like in the article I wrote about it, like I agree it's cynical. But the point I always come back to is I didn't feel any different in leveling in Odyssey than I did in what I've played of, say, Octopath, where you can't go to the next chapter of a story unless you're to a certain level, or, say, like, Dragon Quest VIII or a Final Fantasy. Like, those games also have moments where, like, oh, hey, this boss is, like, level 15. If you're level 10, you're probably not going to survive this fight. And that's sort of part and parcel of an RPG. And I discussed in another article that I think part of the problem that people are having is that they're treating it like an Assassin's Creed game, which it is. But like one of the old Assassin's Creed games where you could literally just do the main story and burn through it, you know, 15 hours or whatever. But since Origins and Odyssey, they're now actually RPGs. So I think they should be treated like RPGs.
In the sense that the way the progression works, the unlocking abilities, the way side quests are handled, is just naturally much more role-playing-esque.
Right. And if you try to bring your expectations of pre-Origins Assassin's Creed to this game, it's not going to work because they're not the same game anymore.
Nope. And you're a little bit sad about that.
I am. I really like Origins and Odyssey, and I think Ubisoft probably made the right decision, because what I see from a lot of people is they didn't really care about Assassin's Creed until the last two.
That's definitely the case for me.
Right. See, there's two right there. But I also think there are a lot of people that enjoyed what it was before, and now there's nothing out there for them. And I enjoyed what was there before. So I enjoy Odyssey and Origins, and I hope that this continues to be the future of the franchise. But I also think there's something to be done for the people who don't want that, who just want the linear stealth action game in the open world.
I'm sure they'll do that at some point.
Yeah, and my point at the end of that article was, back in the day, they used to do two Assassin's Creed games. So, like, Assassin's Creed 3 was joined by Assassin's Creed Liberation, and AC Unity was joined in the same year by AC Rogue, and the other, Liberation and Rogue, were cheaper games, reusing a lot of assets, reusing a lot of mechanics, telling different stories and kind of tweaking it to be unique, but definitely much cheaper than the mainline entries. And I think Ubisoft could use the assets of, say, Odyssey and tell a much cheaper story and provide a game that is shorter, quicker, and more like what classic Assassin's Creed fans want.
Well, this is what I'm waiting for. Are you ready?
Go for it.
Assassin's Creed Vice City. It's all the fun of Assassin's Creed Odyssey, but set in a drug-fueled Miami of the 1980s. Let's do it.
Wow. I'd be surprised if that happens. I think the farthest forward they'll probably go, oh man,
World War II.
World War II is yeah. It. Because Syndicate had World War II in it. Yes. And I think that is the farthest they'll go. Basically, I think they're trying to avoid vehicles, because once they add vehicles, they're stepping on Watch Dogs' toes. And
I feel like all games will, like, going forward, will, like, be expected to have something that is on a horse.
Yeah, so I think what Assassin's Creed is trying to do is stay away from, say, Watch Dogs and Far Cry. So I don't think they'll ever get far enough that vehicles will be a major part of the game, like cars and stuff. Syndicate had carriages and whatnot. And like I said, there was a World War II section of Syndicate. But I think like modern day, they're staying away from, because that to them, I feel, is just essentially Watch Dogs.
I understand. And actually, I was only kidding, but I could see like the 1950s being somewhat fertile ground if you wanted to make it a Cold War spy drama.
Oh,
where yeah. the work. Assassin's working for, say, the CIA. And if you make a particular area into a large map where you're going around and taking on quests for, you know, the CIA or the Russians or something, and you're assassinating targets and making use of different vehicles and everything, that could be a really kind of fun twist on the traditional Assassin's Creed formula. But yeah, you're right. I think that they're going to try and avoid vehicles wherever humanly possible, because and not only that, but it's the historical settings that really set Assassin's Creed apart. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I think the rumor was supposed to be Egypt, Greece, and then Rome as sort of a trilogy. But the original rumor had Bayek. We didn't know he was Bayek at the time in all three of them. And obviously things have changed, so I don't know if the next one will be Rome, but probably. But I think after that will probably be China, because I feel like Romance of the Three Kingdoms is going to be tackled by Assassin's Creed at some point. And next gen feels right.
I hope they take a break next year, because
they are. They've already said they're not doing next year. Yeah.
It's probably Quebec and, gosh, what's the ones that did Origins?
Montreal.
So they're probably like switching off, I'm guessing. And then I guess, yeah.
Yes.
It's a bummer that they already did the American Revolution and the French Revolution and such, because those are all really interesting categories for me, and I would like them to do that with AC Odyssey.
Yeah, that would be nice. That would be very nice.
But of course, the one setting that really had me the most excited, the Revolutionary War, was of course the worst one in the friggin' series. The only Assassin's Creed I've ever bought at launch, and then it let me down in the worst way. But
I still think Origins had like the best settings. It was like an unexpected period of Egypt's history. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like when you think of ancient Egypt, you think of like the New Kingdom area or era with like Ramses and stuff. And I think it's
where they were building.
Yeah, when they were building the pyramids, and when it was like, I was expecting, if Assassin's Creed ever went to Egypt, it would be that era, because it's like so ripe for, it just feels like an Assassin's Creed era. So it's like interesting that they went in with like when Romans were like colonizing Egypt, and I thought that made it like a really interesting era, in addition to just being like an interesting like place to explore in Assassin's Creed. And yeah, I feel like that's like the key to a lot of these like time periods. Like, you want to be in like a cool era, or not cool. Cool is probably the wrong word, but you know, like interesting era, and not just like, oh, this environment would be cool to explore.
Yeah, you kind of want to avoid just the there's that sort of toss up between finding a period where there's a lot of historical figures, a lot of historical porn, so to speak, and something that's sort of unexpected. And I think the unexpected part is the reason, and Matt did a whole article on it, why Ubisoft has been steadfastly avoiding Japan for all this time, despite it being one of the most asked for periods for Assassin's Creed to go to, because Japan is not unexpected. At least not the Japan that most people want.
And there's so many games set in like feudal Japan with like there's just like, even now it's like there's Neo, there's Sekiro, there's whatever the Sucker Punch
Ghost of Tsushima.
That one. I always forget the name of that one. I'm just like, the other one. It's like, there's, I feel like there's so much even now. It's like, if Assassin's Creed did a Japan game, I don't think, like, I feel like core fans would be super stoked, because obviously they really want it, but I don't think it would like have the hit. Like, I don't know, it just doesn't feel like that unique, and I feel like that's what really does set Assassin's Creed apart is it, like, engages with history on, like, a really unique level. So sometimes for the good, sometimes for the bad, but, you know, it does its own little thing, and it, I don't know, I think that's cool in the AAA space especially.
Plus, I think China, because China, I think looking at Egypt and Greece, I think they could knock it out of the park.
There's so many, like, eras that would be really interesting. Like, there's a lot of potential there, and I'm excited to see if it does end up happening. I'm excited to see where they end up.
All right, Assassin's Creed Odyssey is now available on most consoles, and you should go check out all of our coverage. Mike wrote a thing about the microtransactions. He wrote about not wanting traditional Assassin's Creed fans to be left behind. We got quite a bit. Katie wrote her thoughts on the first 20 hours or so and on the story. So there's a lot to talk about with Assassin's Creed Odyssey. In the meantime, this is a bit outside the purview of the RPG podcast, but Mike, you're going to be pretty busy with Black Ops 4 and Red Dead Redemption 2 coverage over the next few weeks.
Yes, I am. Black Ops 4 comes out at the end of today. I've already played part of it, but we're going to be diving pretty hard into that over the next week or two. And then at some point, very soon, Red Dead Redemption 2 should be hitting us so that we can play it. And I'm looking forward to that, despite not actually beating the first Red Dead yet.
All right. Thanks, everybody. And we're going to continue on to the mailbag. Okay, we're going to continue on to the mailbag. Nadia's back with us. And the first mail, last week we talked about Fallout 76 and Fallout New Vegas. Since then, Nadia has posted a whole mess of content on the site. She talked about the VAT system. She talked about the being griefed. You just posted an article about griefing in Fallout 76, I think.
Yeah, someone was being mean to me. They were shooting me when I was trying to, like, enjoy myself. But, yeah, I dealt with that by running away.
Sounds like a world that I can really start to enjoy.
Are you going to be following me around, taking pot shots at my head now, Kat?
No, I'll be, like, meticulously building up my camp, and then I'm going to get shot in the face by some jerk.
Well, like I said in my thing, it's like there's 20 to 25 people on a server in a very, very big game. So I think your chances of meeting someone are generally low. What happened to us is, since we were all in the Greenbrier Hotel, which is where this event was taking place, we all wanted to see the Greenbrier in-game, so we all just kind of convalesced around there. And that's when a firefight broke out, and the rest is history.
Well, this first question is for you, Nadia, our first comment. Moochan says, sorry for being so late, but wanted to see how Savando is for myself from Dragon Quest XI. And while I only just got him in my party, I'm enjoying him. But I always enjoyed just happy, campy characters. My only issue is how the NPC and characters would react to that. Since most anime JRPG tend to make campy just weird and out of place, just yell at them for acting weird. Or worse, with Persona 4, with their use of quote-unquote lighthearted humor with Kanji and Yosuke. Sorry, I know you love Persona 4, but I couldn't keep going after they kept doing the joke over and over again. I'm not actually sure what the Kanji and Yosuke joke is, but okay. So having a colorful, campy guy where everyone seems to just accept and enjoy his camp makes me okay with him.
If I recall correctly, with Kanji and Yosuke, because I actually have another gay friend who really didn't like what was going on there. It was basically Kanji, of course, had the whole gay panic thing going on, and Yosuke was just like, every time Kanji came near him, he's like, oh man, don't give me the gay. Not in so many words, but that's pretty much what happened. And with Silvando, there's really nothing like that. There's one character who doesn't like him, but it's nothing to do with how he acts. It has to do with, like, they have a past together, and character B thinks that he is forsaking his Silvando's forsaking his heritage, so that's in a whole other thing. But yeah, Silvando's very, very campy, but not so much in an offensive way. Katie, you're playing Dragon Quest, aren't you? Do you have any commentary on that?
I just got to Silvando, so, like, introduction, and I love him. Like, he's just, like, this very flamboyant character, and it's just, don't know. I feel like it's like a lot of fun. It's like kind of like a liveliness that is like was almost missing from the cast.
Yeah, he's very fun. That's a good word for him.
Yeah, and like I feel like his abilities seem to be super overpowered, which I like because it kind of matches his personality. You know, he's just like this like ridiculous guy. And yeah, I don't know. I feel like I'm like Sylvanas is probably my favorite party member. So like I guess
he's also awesome. A really really good buffer and debuffer. And he has like yeah. He has a healing spell for the crew. So he's good. He's worth keeping in your party for a long time.
Yeah, he's like the probably the first like ideal party member, I'd say. But yeah, I definitely like feel that with Persona 4. Like I'm also like I like Persona 4, but a lot of that stuff like really annoyed me more than I was able to like look over it, you know. Whereas I feel yeah, like sometimes yeah. I'm able to like kind of like it's like, you know, it's a different culture. Like I guess I it's a bummer, but you know, it's different. But like with 4, it's like a little bit overboard, I'd say, in my opinion. And like 5 has a little bit of it too, but it also has like good depictions of it, like with the drag queen bartender you befriend.
Oh, Lala.
So it's like yeah
she Lala like, was great.
Yeah, it's like such a great character. I'm like, why do you have like this and then you also have this other like the like other gay panic thing? It's like, why? I don't know. It's just a bummer. But yeah, so Vondo, I feel like it's definitely coded as gay, but it's I don't know, it's just, like he doesn't feel like it doesn't feel like unrealistic or something. He's just like this very
definitely
like,
not malicious.
Yeah it's definitely like, oh, like this is a good character, like it's cool.
So Nice Guy Neon says of Fallout 76 they had really enjoyed Morrowind and Oblivion but had gotten bored by Fallout 3 and were kind of wondering why. And they said, the moment I installed New Vegas, I was hooked. Guys shot you in the head, you aren't dead, find them. Easy, exciting, interesting hook. But then Obsidian used the open world to often smartly tie back side quests to your greater character arc. You had to make decisions that mattered rather than, weirdly enough, will you nuke this town or not? And really, like, nukes are serious business, but Fallout 3 managed to make it the most boring choice imaginable. Like, what did you really lose out on? A barren town and then you keep exploring the wasteland like nothing happened? Great. The quest design really elevated New Vegas because the actual game systems were similar, but the quests made you want to keep exploring the quirky world and eventually see how everything could tie in together. Later, I bought Skyrim, hoping Bethesda pulled some magic, but I got 10 hours into Skyrim and never played it again, and I outright skipped Fallout 4 after reading reviews. I don't know what to expect from Fallout 76 or Elder Scrolls 6, but my gut tells me not much. At least Obsidian are successful enough to go on and make their own RPGs now. I like Fallout 4, but I can totally see why somebody would care about Fallout New Vegas more because the choices are more meaningful.
Yeah, something that bothered me about Fallout 3 was Fallout 3 the one with, was it Lucas Sims, the town, the sheriff of that nuke town?
Yes.
Okay, either way, I accidentally shot him in the face, and he just kind of, his body was just on like the doorstep of someone's house, or it was the bar in that town or something like that. And I'm like, can someone please remove this gentleman? Like, his son is right there. Can we do something about this? And I took his hat, but that was it for me and Megaton.
In Fallout 4, there's a town called Covenant, and it can end right, with you killing all of the inhabitants, which I ultimately did because they were bad and they should feel bad. And then after you kill them, once you clear it out, you can turn it into a settlement, which I did because I was very excited about this because I was like, oh, man, now it's a settlement. Now I can kind of decorate these rooms to the way that I like and everything, except that their bodies are all still lying around. So you'll be walking through the settlement and their bodies just kind of laying there on their doorstep. And you're like, ugh. Well, anyway, I'm going to go to bed now. Bye.
One thing I noticed in Fallout 76 is that I don't know about people, but well, there are no people there, but enemies turn into piles of goo and they slowly fade away. So at least they go away after a time. They don't sit there like broken rag dolls.
Max Bebo lists some of the things that they enjoyed about Fallout New Vegas. One, low intelligence actually changing dialogue options. Are you a maker of war or peace? Pizza.
That was great.
Two, yes, man is simply the best. This is going to be great. I'm going to help you accomplish so much, whether I want to or not. Three, best companion, Veronica, voiced by Felicia Day, being as quirky and charming as ever. I've always liked Felicia Day. She's great. I met Felicia Day. I got to interview her once, and she is just as sweet and nerdy in real life as you would totally expect.
So she must have been really happy to be a character in Fallout New Vegas.
She was also in Dragon Age. In fact, that's why they were doing the interview rounds, because they had her playing a character in a side quest in a DLC for Dragon Age 2, if I recall correctly.
Oh, that's cool.
Four, Ulysses is definitely that Chris Avellone character. You know, that character he writes in every game that is super mysterious and drives the plot from behind the scenes, who has complex philosophical beliefs, having been a member of multiple factions, and is usually trying to break a cycle, becoming disillusioned with all of those factions. And even though I've recognized the pattern, I want more of it. That's not a terrible trope to run with. I mean, you could do much worse, to be honest.
You really could.
And as usual, if you want to leave a comment, send me an email at cat.bailey@usgamer.net or leave a comment on the site, on the show notes. We have show notes every week. People have been sending me all kinds of nice mails and tweets and that kind of thing, and it's always really good to hear you. And if you're enjoying the show, which some of you have been saying you have enjoyed the show, and thank you very much, please leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you are listening to your podcast, so that we can get more visibility. And, you know, we always like hearing from you. But Axe the Blood God is a US Gamer podcast. Find us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. All of the social media stuff that I already listed. Lots of great stuff over on the site, as usual. Matt talked about why Fallout 76 fans are feeling kind of aggrieved about Brotherhood of Steel. As we mentioned, there's already Call of Duty Black Ops 4 coverage. I wrote a big article about where Madden 19 went wrong. Nadia did a thing about the Scorch Beast, which we talked about. The answer to Fallout, the answer to Skyrim's dragon, which is kind of terrifying.
Yeah, they are kind of terrifying, to be honest. And I love bats.
Katie wrote about The World Ends With You. And what else have you written lately, Katie?
I don't even remember.
It's kind of a blur, isn't question. It?
I've written like three. So I've been writing things for next week, but then I wrote, God, what else did I write? Oh, I wrote about Assassin's Creed Odyssey, which we talked about in the last section. And I definitely wrote something on Monday that I can't remember what it was. That's where I'm at right now.
You wrote a love letter to Forza Horizon 4's worst cars and the silly designs.
That's what I did. I did that Friday. Yeah. So I wrote about Forza Horizon 4's stupid cars, because I like to make slow cars really ugly, and that's kind of like my hobby with that game.
Yeah, that was the article that convinced me that you're history's greatest monster, actually.
Did you say you make a slow car? I'm sorry, did I hear that?
Yeah, slow car. Like, why would you make... Like, they're just like, you can buy these really cheap, ugly slow cars, and then I just go on like the custom design marketplace, and I'd pick the ugliest design. And then
Imagine passing that on the highway.
I've run to some people, obviously, in the online multiplayer, but it's like, I wonder if people are like judging me for driving.
Do they honk you?
Kinder car.
Move it, grandma.
So, far, so like, yeah, exactly. I want to be like the grandma in Forza.
I see Katie sometimes, anyway, but so. She's never driving one of the slow cars.
I think it's my ghost, because I see your name in there a lot, but I know it's like, because that's, like, the thing that Forza does. Like, it takes the names from your, like, friends list.
Oh, yes.
And puts them in the game on, like, just ghost cars. Like, just, like, random.
Driving Oldsmobiles.
Like, yeah, it's just, like, well, it's just, like, random, like, basically NPCs. But it's, like, they have your friends. Because I'm, like, I know this person doesn't have Forza. But then I see, like, their name on a car driving around. It's really strange.
That was weird when I was reviewing it. Because I was, like, these people definitely don't have Forza. And yet.
Yeah, exactly. And yet, here they
are. Mom, you have the game?
All right, we'll be back as usual next week. And until for Katie, Nadia, and myself, thanks for listening. And until then, happy adventuring.